This is Talk is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, simulcast on KPW.org and archived on radioforall.net. So, special edition of Talk is Cheap today. I've got bass player extraordinaire, bass player god, stick player Tony Levin promoting the Beat Tour, where Steve Vai has joined Adrian Belew, Tony Levin, and Denny Carey from Tool for the Beat Tour's 80s King Crimson songs. About Tony Levin, over the past half century, Tony Levin has been a prolific session player and one of the most active live performers on the planet. He's contributed his talents to over 500 albums, amongst which include 15 with Peter Gabriel, 18 with King Crimson, alongside contributions to the work of John Lennon, Alice Cooper, Lou Reed, Herbie Mann, Paul Simon, and many others. On tour, he's traveling the world many times over with aforementioned King Crimson, Peter Gabriel, and several of his own bands, including Stickmen. This fall, he'll stage 65 performances in North America as a member of Beat, celebrating King Crimson's 80s repertoire alongside Adrian Belew, Steve Vai, and Denny Carey, interpreting Discipline, Beat, and Three of a Perfect Pair. And there's some surprises in that, too. They're at the McDonald Theater on November 23rd. And so it's selling out fast, but it has not sold out at the McDonald Theater on November 23rd. So, like I say, coming up, very special edition. Really happy, and I was starstruck in this interview, so yeah, that's my excuse anyway. Tony Levin, bass player extraordinaire Tony Levin, promoting his new album that's available on Flatiron Records and the Beat Tour. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media.
Had to take a break from touring. You tour so much that this is why you couldn't do the album, right? You're constantly on tour.
That's right. Yeah, it's a good problem to have, isn't it? Too much work. Too much work of doing what I love. So I love playing live, playing shows, and I get the chance to do it a lot. And when I'm home, I do a couple things. I play on other people's albums, some which I enjoy from my home studio. And of course, being a musician, I write music and I like to release albums. So about a year ago, I looked at all the material I had, really a lot of material. And I thought, if I don't really carve out some time, I'm never going to quite finish it and never put out that album. And I really wanted to. So I carved it down and I did a few more tracks, but pretty much it involved taking a couple months off early in 2024 to finish it, to get the other players on it, and to make it the kind of album I wanted it to be.
All right. And you had plenty of material, so much so that you dropped the prog rock stuff, it says.
Oh, I didn't know you knew that. Yes, yeah, I had a lot of material without a cohesive direction to it, because it's just what I had written in the last 5-10 years. And I dropped some of it for a future album. And I also wrote some new stuff, of course, because one is always doing that. And so I have what are to me some classic pieces on this album that I wrote, I don't know how many years ago, a few years ago, and tweaked in the last year. And I have some brand new stuff that I just wrote.
And so the album is called Bringing Down the Walls, or Bringing Down the Bass.
Bringing it down to the bass, which is, I figure, if there's anything I know about after all these years of playing the bass, it's the bass. And individually, the pieces, they're not bass solos, but they begin, each of the pieces, with a few, couple of exceptions, each of the pieces begins with a bass sound or a bass technique, maybe plucking or maybe a finger thumb picking or something like that, a technique or a sound on the bass. And then it expands to have what I think the most special thing is about the album is the great other players I brought in.
Do you have Al Foster, who is the SNL, that signature sound from the Saturday Night Live? But what I remember him from was the song Perspective and Home Sweet Home with Peter Gabriel.
All right.
as well.
He's great. He's a friend, but I think that Alex Foster is a great example of me bringing in players. When these players come in to play on your piece, your composition, they give you so much. They give of themselves. You're just paying them a few bucks for their hours, but really, when you think about it, it's a lifetime of devotion to their craft, and it's all their talent, all their practice, and all that. So actually, the first piece on the album is called Bringing It Down to the Basin, and when I wrote it, it was fine, and it had a horn section doing the melody. But when I realized I was bringing in Alex among that horn section, I thought, I can't have him here and not play a solo because I love his playing. So I added on a section at the end and a quick fade out section, really after the piece ended. And to me, that's still my favorite part of the album, hearing what he did on that 30 seconds of extra coda music before the song ends.
Something about his tone, I like him better than Clarence Clemons even, really.
I'm not a guy who picks favorites, but he's a fantastic talent, and I'm honored and lucky to have him playing a little on my album.
All right, and so then you did a song about being on the road because you're on the road so much, and you mix the vocoder with your bass?
Not exactly. The piece is called Road Dogs. It's just an interesting process. I don't want to talk all day about it, but I write an instrumental. Right. And I think, I'll call it Road Dogs. And then when I'm getting to writing the last section, I thought, well, what would be really cool here is a fretless bass through a vocoder. A vocoder, for those who don't know, is a way that you say the words with the microphone and your instrument sounds like it's talking in a way. And okay, that was my idea, but I didn't have a vocoder on hand. Who does? And I knew I could get one, and I thought, well, while this idea is fresh, I'm just going to lay down a vocal of what it'll sound like. And I went literally, and I'm clearing my throat, I went, road dogs, nothing but road dogs. And I vocally did what I thought the bass would sound like. Okay, fast forward a month, and I'm trying different vocoder type effects, and it sounds terrible. It just doesn't work. And I kept hearing that vocal that I laid down as a guide. And I said, well, you know what? Why fight it? Suddenly this instrumental piece became a vocal. And I added a few other words about loading in and busing and trucking and stuff like that. But essentially it's an instrumental that became a vocal.
Well, you mentioned fretless. Now, I've never noticed you play fretless, and even the stick has frets right on it.
I certainly have played fretless bass, because my first instrument was the upright bass, which is fretless. So I played fretless bass in a way before I played the even fretted bass. But I like them both, and the Chapman stick that I play a lot, especially on this tour, the beat tour that I'm on right now as we speak, that has frets, very much has frets. It's hard enough. It's strange enough and fascinating instrument with frets to take the frets off. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. I'm not ready to handle that.
But, no, I guess I have it backwards. Mick Karn toured and you were on Cloud About Mercury.
That sounds right. Yeah. So David is a great, great friend and a great guitar player, by the way. And I brought him in on a piece called Bungee Bass, which is named simply because it's an instrumental and the bass sound I started with sounds like a bouncing bungee chord. Actually, my one mistake on the album, I think the one mistake I know about it is I misspelled bungee. It should be two E's at the end. And I ended it with IE. But oh, well, it was when I realized that it was too late to change the artwork. So that is the title.
I can see where his style would fit with a bungee chord.
Absolutely. David just don't know what he's going to do. But you know it won't be like anything you ever heard or anything any other guitar player will play. So that's that's what the piece called for. I'll just do this bungee bass sounding. I'll have my great friend Pat Mastellotto play a creative drum loop underneath it. And we'll have David go to town.
Well, and I got to ask, though, Bruford tells the story of how his samples would never, you could never get the samples to end with the rest of the band. must be the anchor of the band. You're the one keeping time in the band with all this stuff going on.
Well, it's different in different situations. Certainly in the 80s when I toured, and now I'm doing the music of the 80s with the beat tour, reliving it. But in the 80s when we toured, yes, samples, you couldn't control them. You could play them once or twice, but if you want to loop them, good luck. It's not going to work with the band. However, of course, technology has marched on, and nowadays the drummers that I tour with can and do use loops, and they can work out a way that they end right when we end.
And how about soundscapes? You did there's a Fripp soundscape song on the new album too.
Yes. Yes, well, touring with King Crimson, we've stopped touring now, but the last, oh, I don't know how many years, 10 years of touring, Robert Fripp, the band's founder and a glorious guitar player, an amazing musician, he would start the show actually after sound check, 4 in the afternoon. He would write, compose a what we call a soundscape of him playing guitar and overdubbing on top of himself, and that would play as the audience came in, right up until we hit the stage at 8 o'clock. And some nights at 8 o'clock, Robert would suggest, as we're lined up right off the King Crimson, a very punctual band, we would start at 8 o'clock, not 8:01 at all. And as we're lined up the backstage, he would say, "Hey, Tony, when you go out, you go ahead and play bass to my soundscape." So some nights, on his instruction or his suggestion, I would do that. So fast forward to my making my album, and I thought, well, you know what? I got a really special bass with a special bass sound. And I wrote Robert, and I said, "What do you say? I take one of your many soundscapes and write a piece to it." So I did, and that's the piece called "Floating in Dark Waters."
All right, and now I thought all along that you were from Woodstock, New York, but and then you lived in Manhattan, it says, but you're from Boston. Now,
Originally from,
before you go, I
yeah.
know nothing about sports, but I know I know I remember Larry Bird and the Lakers, and everything stopped. I was working grocery back then, and everything stopped in the grocery store when Larry Bird of the Celtics played the Lakers. So
Wow.
I remember that,
Yes.
but.
Yes. Well, I go back that far and further back. Actually, I had already left Boston probably by that time. Yeah, great sports town. Whether you like their teams or not, it's a good sports town and a very interesting town. And yes, I moved from there to Woodstock, New York, a haven for musicians. A lot of us musicians live there. I still live in that area, and I still go back to Boston once in a while. And I intentionally wanted a piece on my album that tried in my musical way to express both sides of the Boston experience, and that it's a kind of a rough, gruff town, a rock town, especially involving its sports teams. But it's also a historic city with a lot of universities and a very intellectual city. So how do you combine those two into a peaceful? Well, I tried, and it starts off with me just kind of yelling "rock, rock hard," back with my Boston accent. So I was saying "rock hard," and then it goes into a kind of poem I wrote, importing a couple of JFK quotes, but pretty much a poem about the history and sense of downtown Boston.
And what did John Lennon have to do with Boston and Earl Slick? You like his Earl Slick's guitar playing, right?
That piece, Boston Rocks, I wanted to, I envisioned, I couldn't play, but envisioned a real heavy rock solo and kind of going wild throughout it. And Earl Slick's a great friend of mine. We played together with David Bowie on record, and on record with John Lennon. And I see him every few years, not all the time. So I begged him to play on the track, which he did. He came up to Woodstock, to my area, and overdubbed, and indeed he rocked out. And I also on that track brought in Mike Portnoy, my bandmate from the band Liquid Tension Experiment. And Mike is very busy this year with Dream Theater recording, and they're going to do a big tour. But he kindly found a break in his schedule and came in to play that same piece. As
Now,
you can tell from you can tell about the album, it's really all over the place and got a whole lot of great players on it. And each piece I could talk about 10 minutes about who I brought in and why I brought them in and how it worked out.
well, that's what I can't believe how many players you've played with. I mean, I didn't know you were on. Well, like I say, where were you on John Lennon? Were you in the time when Alan White, Plastic Ono Band, had Alan White, which later was with Yes? So
Yeah.
did you know Alan White when you were with John Lennon?
I know Alan White. I knew Alan White and played with him. And by the way, you mentioned David Torn earlier. David Torn and Alan White and I did a trio album of called Levin Torn White. So yes, I know Alan well, but that's not the period I was with John Lennon. I did the last album, which was made into two albums. So it was Milk and Honey was the second one,
Is that Double Fantasy, right?
Yeah, Double Fantasy with Yoko. Yes, that's what I did. My experience with John was very special, but it was really very short, only a few weeks in the studio.
Fire Across the Sky.
Actually, interesting piece, and I just am fashioning a video that's going to come out in the next few days of that. it's kind of fun to make a video of a piece and see where it goes beyond the piece. But the piece Fire, it's a poem. It's me speaking a poem or reciting it and only playing the Chapman stick. It's an unusual instrument. I did overdub more than one stick onto it, but it's a kind of quieter piece than the rest of the rock album. And it is about John Lennon, but it doesn't mention him. So maybe a wiser man than I would not even say it's about him. It's an interesting poem about being a New Yorker and a kind of a profound experience, but it doesn't mention John by name, but I have to admit it's about him.
But you used a Paraguayan composer, Agustin Barrios.
Yes, you've done your homework. Golly, how do you, I don't know. Oh, okay, I see you have a sheet of paper. Yes, thank you for the homework. Yeah, a piece, when I'm writing a piece, I let it go where it goes. And then I edit myself later and think things like, well, that sounds like another piece. I shouldn't use that. Or I should make it more different than the other piece. So this album, my kind of overall rule was to not edit myself, to just let it go musically where it goes. That's why the piece Road Dogs became a vocal, even though the piece wanted to be a vocal, even though I intended it as an instrumental. So this piece, I was in Germany on what I call a writing trip, where I just bring my instrument and just get an Airbnb. And this one was in Berlin, and just spent a week writing and hanging out in cafes. And I finished the poem and I fashioned some music to it, the piece Fire Across the Sky. And at the end, just going over it in my little Airbnb apartment, I just kind of went into a classical piece that I can't play on classical guitar. I used to practice classical guitar. I can't quite play it, but it went into that melody. And I thought, well, later I'll change it. But the way the ethic of this album was to leave it be. So I said, all right, that's instead of editing myself, instead of second guessing myself, I'll just shrug my shoulders and say, musically, it just wanted to go there. So it did. And I let it.
And then you added your own, you're writing your own lyrics too. You write lyrics.
Oh yeah, well, the piece is a poem. It's only at the very end, kind of as a coda. It goes into just a different piece, a classical piece, which in my sensibilities just seemed to work with it musically, so I let that happen.
All right, so on the drums, what you just mentioned a bunch of drummers' names that you've worked with. Is that what that song is?
Picture the lockdown year, and musicians, road musicians like me, had nothing. I had no gigs and nothing could go, and I should have just probably finished my album. But instead, I did a number of things. I finished a photo book and released that. But also, I got it into my slightly crazed head to write a song using the names of drummers I've played with. Now, I've been playing for a long time, so that's a lot of drummers. So I spent maybe a month online trying to get the list of names. And then, of course, these names didn't rhyme, and I wanted to only use their names, nothing else. So it ended up being a choral piece with maybe 16 voices of my voice. And it goes some interesting places, but the most interesting, it names a whole lot of drummers, and it kind of makes them work musically together. It's called On the Drums. And again, I have a very nice video of it out on, I guess the safest place to say to go for that would be tonylevin.com has a link to it. But there's a nice video which has written out the names of the drummers so you can be sure whose names you heard. But I haven't counted how many names it is, but it's certainly a lot. And it was a musical, it was a steep mountain to climb, let me put it that way, musically, to make it work musically, all of those names.
And so I didn't realize you played with Buddy Rich. I see Buddy Rich was a perfectionist. Did you notice? What do you got to say about Buddy Rich?
I could talk about half the day about playing with Buddy. It's we jazz players in the 60s and 70s, a lot of stories were hanging around about how difficult Buddy could be, in addition to being an awesome player. And I actually left. I was in school in Rochester and had the chance to join the Buddy Rich Band, and left town having been pretty established there as a musician. And then I found that Buddy actually changed his mind and didn't want another bass player in the band. And I was in Boston, ironically, when I found that out. And then I didn't know what to do, so I went to New York in a move that I might not have made otherwise. It worked out really well for me. And coincidentally, a couple of years later, who should come to New York but the Buddy Rich Band, minus a bass player, and they needed a bass player to do a couple, I think, three nights in a club, and then record an album called The Roar of 74. So I got to play with Buddy in that club and then on that album. And then he asked me indirectly through the manager if I'd like to tour with him again. And I kind of laughed at that and said, well, no, actually, I tried that once and you changed your mind and didn't want me. So I'll just stay with this New York career that I have.
And again, I'm sure he keeps time, but you're part of the rhythm section.
Your buddy kept more than extraordinarily powerful and energy. Anyone who's heard him knows he's really unique and a fantastic drummer who drove the big band. He always had a big band with him, and he really, really dragged them along with him in a really exciting jazz way. And it was an honor to play with him and great fun.
You list Nick Mason in here with Pink Floyd.
And what I did was I played on an album of new stuff called Momentary Lapse of Reason.
All right.
And I played on that album. I did not tour with them, so I didn't get to play the other bass parts, but they're iconic. They're really great bass parts. In a way, I have a lot of experience with a similar situation when I've toured with King Crimson, which I joined in 1980, but it had been around a long time before that. So I got to have the challenge, I would put it, the challenge of playing other bass players' parts that are really great. And the challenge is, I came to feel that the challenge was to keep true to what's iconic, what's very special about that part, but not play the part exactly as it was, or not even think that way, but to make my own part, because that's what I do well, and that's what I love to do on the road, is to fashion a part for the piece. So that's a challenge, and would have been had I toured with Pink Floyd to play Roger Waters' parts. But let me also say that it's a common thing among music listeners, when a lead singer is a great bass player, one tends to not honor him for what a great bass player he is. Think about the Sting's bass playing, which is fantastic, and Paul McCartney's bass playing, fantastic, really inspired a lot of us bass players, and Roger Waters. So, when the guy's a lead singer, you tend to kind of brush off his great bass parts. So, good work on your part, bringing that whole subject into the light.
Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, and Howe playing Chris Squire's parts.
Same story. Chris's parts are iconic. They define the piece. And indeed, I did, in some of them, I still stuck almost completely to the part because I just couldn't envision or imagine anything that improved it.
But he's playing with a pick, and you and Jeff Berlin are both, Jeff Berlin also sat in for him. In there, but you guys are playing jazz style, aren't you? Were you playing with a pick in Yes?
I determined before that tour, it was called Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, Howe tour, and I was listening to those parts, and I thought, either I'm going to have to practice a whole lot with my pick playing, because I can play with the pick, but not very well, and Chris Squire was phenomenal at it, or I could take these unusual drumsticks I have, which I call the funk fingers, where I play with drumsticks. I started doing that with Peter Gabriel on the So album in 1985. I can take those and spend my hours practicing those instead. And so that's how I did that tour. I was playing pretty much Chris's parts on the older material. We did new material also, but pretty much his parts, but not with the pick and not with a Rickenbacker bass sound, but with my own sound and with the funk fingers, but the same, trying to play the same parts as well as I could.
Yeah,
as best as I could.
You noticed the difference, and it worked really well, because you still have that, that's just it, as you play, you don't play fretless, but you still have that warm tone with the staccato tone, and haven't I seen you, both you and Adrian Blue, don't you literally stop the strings with your fingers and then start the vibration of the strings again with your fingers?
Boy, I don't know, I never thought of it that way, but I'm going to have to look at myself and see what it is I'm doing. I'll put it a different way. There's a lot of techniques that come around and that you try, especially in a band like King Crimson or the B Tour we're doing now. A whole lot of techniques, and I don't really think about them all, especially the ones I've been doing for a lot of years. Let me speak about the B Tour, by the way. We're really having fun. Audiences are loving it. We're really looking forward to coming to Eugene. It's a great music town. I've been there probably every year for a number of years and in one context or another. Although the last time I came, there was an ice storm, terrible ice storm, and I wasn't able to play. I was there with the jazz band last January. Wow, a lot of ice.
Yeah.
So this time in November, I hope we'll be there before the ice and able to play our show. I'm very much looking forward to playing there.
Well, the last time I saw you here was at the Wow Hall, and the whole audience sang Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, okay, it was with California Guitar Trio.
Yeah, yeah.
That's wonderful. I played the Wow Hall Wow, a whole lot with different bands, including my own band and King Crimson offshoots and things like that. It's a good music town. Always good to come back to the cities that appreciate music that's a little different than the most popular music.
All right, and then you played the stand-up cello, I believe, at that show.
You're testing me. If you test me on an individual show, I might have trouble remembering. But I have an electric bass, upright bass called the NS Electric Upright, and I have the cello called the NS Electric Cello. Both are on stands, so they just stand there on the stage, and you walk up to them and play them. And yes, I think I did have it with me on the California Guitar Trio tour. Now that you remind me.
Right, and sang Elephant Talk, which was fantastic to hear you singing Elephant Talk. It works with you on that. But
well, thank you. It must have seemed like a good idea. I'm very relieved to be on tour with Adrian Belew and have him singing it, because he wrote it and it should be him singing it.
Well, but you like Barbershop Quartet, and I remember seeing you at the Greek in 1980. You guys did, I believe you guys did Excuse Me from the second Peter Gabriel album.
With Peter, it was I think on his first album, but I talked him into throwing a Barbershop Quartet. Peter, being English, hardly knew what Barbershop Quartet is, and I grew up with it. It's kind of a genre I really like, so I talked him into that. And then when we were on tour, we did a Barbershop Quartet and a rock show, which is very unusual, but typical for Peter Gabriel to try things that other people aren't doing.
Well, and so you do a Barbershop Quartet on your new album, too, right?
Different subject, but yes, I had a poem about the experience. You'll know what this is, the experience that maybe young people don't know, of getting up and turning your record over to side B and hearing, waiting to hear what it's going to be and how different it's going to be or similar or what. That's a kind of a visceral experience, and I thought I'd write a poem about that, and I turned it into a Barbershop Quartet.
Well, getting back to Gabriel, I don't really know whether I saw you play the tuba, but you, because I used to play trombone in high school, in junior high, and I didn't realize at that time that the tuba and the brass is the bass of the band. So, right, it has the same tuning note.
Yeah,
so
the tuba is. Way back in ancient history, even before my time, it was expected that the bass player would play tuba also. It's just in bands, that's what you did. You played bass and tuba. So I didn't have to do that, but when I was a kid in high school, I picked up the tuba. Why not? It's fun. It's playing the low notes, which I love to do. And again, Peter, in 1976, I'm playing with Peter Gabriel, and he has this piece called Excuse Me. And I thought, well, what if I play tuba on that piece? And he let me. And then, of course, that led to bringing the tuba on the road. I've stopped playing tuba nowadays for a really simple reason. I have a mustache, and like the trombone, it ain't so easy to play a brass instrument with a big mouthpiece. If you have a mustache, the air is leaking out. So I've given some things you got to give up in life, and I gave up the tuba.
Well, so, but did you start on the tuba before you picked up the bass, or you started with the bass?
Thank you. Actually, I started on a piano and then switched at a young, maybe 10 years old. I started playing the bass, and pretty much I'm doing the same thing I did when I was 10 years old. I'm pretty much focusing on the bass. But yes, through the years, I picked up tuba a little bit and the Chapman stick and things like that.
All right. So another drummer is Gary Husband. And now I know him from being with Alan Holdsworth.
Yeah.
So anything on what you did a song with Gary Husband, but anything on Holdsworth?
A good friend. We play together a lot. I have a band called Stickmen when I'm not touring with King Crimson or Peter Gabriel or the Beat Tour. Stickmen goes out sometimes, and we so admire Gary as a player that we invited him to join us as a guest on a tour. Gee, it was a tour in early 2020, a very bad time to be touring. And as we got to Japan, our tour of China, which was upcoming the next month, was canceled, of course, because COVID happened. And we came back. But anyway, we're old friends, and we get together a lot. And I brought him in for one piece, and he did a great job on keyboard. Gary's one of those rare people who plays fantastic on more than one instrument. He's a drummer, and he's a keyboard player.
And
that piece is called Beyond the Bass Clef.
Had you known him from John McLaughlin?
No, no. You know what? It so goes back so far. I don't remember how I knew him. I don't know. Remember? I'll have to ask Gary. Where did we meet and how? Because I don't remember.
I got to ask about Stanley Clarke and Return to Forever, because you mentioned Lenny White, who I think is a fantastic drummer. But, you know, Return to Forever, I like Bruford much better, the Bruford band. I know you weren't in Bruford, but for me, they were much better. Return to Forever just kind of was kind of repetitive, where Bruford's was trying, you know, trying that fusion thing was better. And
well, I don't have an opinion about those, but I'd love that about music, that there's so much of it and that there are subtle differences and there are great, huge differences. So we can find people who feel the same as we do about certain bands and bands and concerts that inspired us. But also we can go off on our own or just have our own opinions about it. I think that's a great thing.
Well, all right. So, and Billy Cobham, I was listening to Red Baron the other day. You'd be perfect on Red Baron. You know, what did you What did you do on with Billy Cobham?
I have not played with Billy Cobham in some time. The one that comes to mind is when he toured with Peter Gabriel for a short time when Manu Katché couldn't make it. And I already was friends with Billy and knew him from our New York City days. I think we were both studio players in New York way, way back. And I don't remember particularly any albums that we played on. We certainly didn't play together on significant jazz albums because we were both doing rock and different kinds of studio playing.
All right,
so we go way back.
And I know Steve Gadd from the first time I heard Steve Gadd was on Al DiMilla's Tour de Force.
Uh-huh.
And he's a good friend of yours. But to me, you know, he played double kick bass much before Dennis Chambers or any of those guys. Is he a pioneer on the double kick bass or?
Not that I know of, but I don't follow the details of that stuff. But Steve and I go way back. We were in school together, classical music school, Eastman School of Music in Rochester. And Steve was my mentor when I began playing jazz. He brought me on jazz bands, and I ended up playing with Chuck Mangione and Gap Mangione way back in the 60s in Rochester. And then we moved to New York together and became studio players in New York and toured with Paul Simon together and a number of bands. So Steve and I go way back. And yes, of course, brought him in for one track on my album called Espressoville, which starts off with the sampled sound of my espresso machine, which is how every day starts off for me at home. And I couldn't resist having Steve on that, both because he was musically right for the track and also because it was Steve who, back when we were young, started me drinking espresso and coffee in the first place.
All right, and you mentioned Paul Simon. You know, to me, Peter Gabriel's world music stuff was way before both Sting and Graceland. And I noticed you're not on Graceland, but Adrian's on Graceland. And this question is,
yeah.
I know you weren't on the world music, but to me, Gabriel was way ahead of these guys, and with Biko too. I never knew who Biko was until I saw Gabriel play that.
And you know what? I once heard an interview with Bono, where he was, you two had a lot of social awareness and used their fame in that direction. And he was, I think it wasn't an interview, it was a speech he gave in South Africa, I think. And I was there with Peter. And he was saying how it was when he heard Biko of Peter Gabriel that he was inspired and learned some stuff and was inspired to maybe use some of his notoriety to help the world in that way.
All right, so back to the Beat Tour. My friend's already seen you guys in L.A., and he says that Denny Carey just hops right into Bruford's parts.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Did Murata train Jerry Murata train Carey or?
Danny learned. He did his homework. He learned these parts. Frankly, he knew them because he has told me he was a fan of the band and Bill Bruford of the band in the 80s. So he kind of grew up listening to us. And for those who don't know, the Beat Tour is Adrian Belew and myself, who were in King Crimson in the 80s, playing the music of those years, the very good music from the three albums we did then, but also with Steve Vai on guitar, just doing a fantastic job at covering Robert Fripp's almost impossible to play guitar parts. And then Danny Carey, the drummer of Tool, has joined us to play Bill Bruford's parts. But both Steve and Danny are not covering the parts and playing them exactly, thank goodness, they're not playing them exactly the way they were. They're being themselves also because they're great musicians. And my joy every night, my excitement is not just to revisit this music, but to hear where these two guys are taking it. Adrian and I are also changing things a bit from what they were, but it's really inspiring to hear that music that's worth it, that the compositions that are special enough and deserve it can be taken in different directions.
And yeah, Steve Vai uses his own little effects, I noticed, but he did an incredible version of Sheltering Sky with you, you know, juxtaposed with you at the bass. That is incredible.
Yeah, that. Thank you. That's a piece that has a lot of soundscapes or cloud sounds. That's a way to describe when the guitar player is making chords that don't just suddenly attack, but just kind of come and go. Look the way clouds do. Yeah, he does a fantastic job. He's not playing at all the same notes that Robert Fripp played, but he's in that area, but also he sounds like Steve Vai. Thank goodness, that's what we want.
When I notice he's tapping up on the neck, which Fripp doesn't do that hardly at all.
No, Robert has a very particular picking technique that's very difficult, and Steve can do that, but often he simulates that by doing exactly tapping on the neck the way you described.
All right, and you guys are playing Red too, which wasn't on the trio.
Well, okay, that's a secret. How do you know that?
Oh, you're not supposed to know that. Oh, I'm not supposed to tell that.
You can say it. I'm not going to say that to the audience. I'm not going to say they were going to play Red, but yes, we have been. And yeah, that's an interesting break from the whole show of music of the three albums of the 80s.
Well, but you don't play any chance you're going to play 21st Century Schizoid Man, though.
Very little chance. Somewhere between zero and zero and a half.
You know, I'd love to hear you guys do. I saw you down in LA at the Hard Rock Cafe with Danny Carey was there then.
Yeah.
And it was with Tool was opening, and they played 21st Century Schizoid Man.
I wasn't on that tour, but yeah, I heard about that. Yeah, Schizoid Man is great. And when I say there's no chance we'll play it, it's because this tour leg we're very busy. We're playing almost every night. But when there's a break in the tour, and there will be before the tour is over, we have discussed maybe bringing in some other material that we're not doing in this first half of the tour.
Well, because it would be interesting to see what Steve Vai does with the guitar solo of that.
Yeah.
But I suggest we were backstage with Adrian, and I'd like to hear the reggae version of 21st Century Schizoid Man,
great. I love it.
You know, do a little twist
put on
there.
Yeah, that's great. I'm ready.
All right, so anything else you want to cover? The show's The show's not sold out here yet in Eugene, but I'm pitching it to everyone here to try to get it sold.
Thank you. You know, we've covered a lot, and thanks for mentioning my album and some details about it. And we're excited. Like I said, I'm excited to come to Eugene. I hope people hear about it and want to take a chance on an evening of King Crimson music, including Steve Vai and Danny Carey.
All right. Tony Levin of Beat and many, many other bands. Thank you very much for your time and doing this.
Thank you for your time. Thanks for having me, man. Thank you.
Jerry, Jerry Marotta, Jerry, Jerry Marotta, Jerry, Jerry Marotta,
Otto, Gavin,
Jerry, Jerry Marotta, Joe Bonadio,
Torres,
Alan Schwartzberg,
Ringo Starr,
Omar Hakim, Carmine Apice, Nick Mason, Ellen White, Chad Wackerman, Omar Hakim, Carmine Apice, Nick Mason, Ellen White, Chad Wackerman,
Gary Chester, Carl Parker, John O'Brien,
Harvey Sorgan, Omar Hakim, Peter Erskine, Randy Charlante, Matt Apps, Nick Rich, Claudio Fossati, Phil Collins, J.R. Robinson, Jim Gordon, Greg Potter, Mark Brzezicki, Omar Hakim, Carmine Apice, Jimmy Young, Zach Alpha, Billy Mundy, Bobby Ray, Bill Bruford, Bill Bruford, Bruford, Bill Bruford, Malcolm Moore, Russ Kunkel, Luther Riggs, and Louis Fragasson, Bill Bruford, Bruford, Bill Bruford, Larry London, Richard Crooks, Jeff Siegel, Joe Vitale, Bill Bruford, Bruford, Bill Bruford, Doug Yowell, Shabby Reina, and Narada, Michael Walden.
Manu Kache, Manny Asses, Annie Carey, Manu Kache, Mickey Curry, Alan Berger, Manu Kache, Aaron Comas, Kenny Aronoff, Manu Kache, Terry Bozio, Terry Bozio, Terry Bozio, 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 Bozio,
Bill Bruford, Bruford, Bill Bruford, Stuart Copeland, Will Calhoun, Kenny Lovett, Rich Sullivan, Bill Bruford, Bill Bruford, Bruford, Bill Bruford, Sean Pelton, Bo Siegel, Jeff Dugmore, Ronnie Zito, Bill Bruford, Bill Bruford, Bruford, Bill Bruford, Rick Marotta, Rick Marotta, Rick, Bill Bruford, Bill Bruford, Bruford, Bill Bruford, Jeremy Stacy, Troy Jones, Lenny Malate, Bunny, Carlos, Marco, Minimus, Husband Richard Edelman,
Jack Legion,
Eric Parker, Chris and Tony,
Tony,
Chico Hamilton, Trelock, Gurtu, Lenny Clayton, Vinny Ruggiero, Jay Bella Rose, Nick Lever, Jitchy Haywood, Terry Silver, Zach Dieter, Panetta, Rick Marotta,